Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 107 for June 16, 2011. Good on you, mate. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks for joining us, folks, and joining me as always for the show, too, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
It took me an hour to get here.
Oh, my gosh. Traffic?
Yeah, there was a horrendous wreck on eastbound 696, and it was just a parking lot.
Yeah, and it's been raining on and off today, and it always slows
people. So the westbound people have to, you know, totally screw their everything up by slowing, you know, typical.
Yeah, typical. Hey, and joining us from Sydney, Australia, we have Peter Robinson with us via Skype. Peter, thanks for joining us here.
Hello.
Well, you can say more than hello.
Hello, hello. Well, g'day. How's that?
Now we know you're there. Thank you. So let's talk about some of the news in this week, and then I want to very much get to what's going on in the Australian market. But here we go again. California is mandating electric vehicles. Now, remember, I think this is, if I remember right, their third attempt at it. And the first two attempts ended in disaster because, as I've said before, even though you can mandate car companies having to build electric cars, you cannot mandate that consumers buy them. And this time, California says by 2018, they want 5.5% of all the cars sold in the state to be electrics. That would be some 81,000 EVs, which is more than all the hybrids they sell in California right now, by the way.
Yeah, well, you know, I just wrote a very complimentary column about the true believers in the business, and especially with General Motors, what they did with the Volt. But I got to tell you, there is a malicious element in California. And it's about time that the enthusiasts in California, I'm tired of hearing from my enthusiast readers, and there's some great enthusiast readers in California. There's great driving roads, great ability to enjoy your cars out there. You enthusiasts have to gear up and really start taking these crackpot politicians down, or you are not going. You're going to wake up in 2018 and wishing you weren't living there. So something's got to give, because the politicians in Northern California and in Washington, with this environmental shoving the EV thing down everyone's throats, is not going to work. It is not going to work. So you either get them out of office, you change the rules, or something's going to have to change. Like in Washington, this one standard has to be in effect. And or we're just going to have to, you know, write off California. I don't know what else to say, because they continue to go down the road that's not sustainable and not affordable and costly in every respect. This country exists because people have a choice, and we have to allow people to make the choices. If EV works, if you have a huggable day in Santa Rosa and you can drive 2.3 miles to your collective to do whatever you're going to do that day and drive 2.3 miles back, or maybe 2.8, because you have to stop at the local collective farm to get your groceries to come home, fine, drive an EV. That's your choice. But if your neighbor wants to drive a 4x4 with 400 horsepower and put fuel in it, that's his business. This shoving down the throat of the citizenry by these politicians has got to stop. And I'm putting the onus on the enthusiasts in California. You know, get together, get strong, get political, get active. Do something about it, because you aren't going to like it.
You're right. And it's not only just the mandate that's there. It's the incredibly generous you know, subsidies of these cars, $7,500 federal tax credit, $5,000 from the state of California on top of that. You know, it's crazy how they're force-feeding this technology and pouring taxpayer money into making it happen.
And don't forget, this is a state that's been hovering in bankruptcy for years. I mean, they've got huge debt and just a tremendous amount of problems, and this is what they focus on. This anti-business, anti-consumer, anti-everything. But, boy, we're going to be happy when all our EVs are plugged in and we got nowhere to go because we got no jobs. Nobody cares. The population's leaving the state, and that'll be it. You know, it's just, it's very frustrating that we are even having this conversation yet again.
Yet again. Yet again. Peter Robinson, what's the situation in Australia? I'm sure there's a bunch of people pushing for electric cars there as well.
Sure, there are. There are, and a number of the city councils are trying to encourage people to buy electric cars. At the moment, there are no electric cars on sale in Australia. There's a Mitsubishi coming along mid-year, but again, it's going to be three times the price of a petrol version of that car. The problem we have in Australia is that most of our energy comes from brown coal. And if you are creating energy in that way, then while electric cars will be environmentally friendly in a city area, globally and nationally, absolutely the opposite is true, because you're creating more emissions by burning the coal in order to create the electricity to charge the cars. So it just doesn't work. And the same thing applies in China, where I think between 75 and 80% of their energy comes from coal, a lot of it exported from Australia.
No, you're absolutely
it's
right.
It's ludicrous.
It is ludicrous. In this country, I think we're 60% coal-generated electricity. And so, you know, I think there should be a truth in advertising hearings here. Nobody should be able to call an electric car zero emissions. And that's what California's mandate actually is. It's what they call the ZEV mandate, zero emission vehicle.
Yeah, it's
well,
not
an
true.
Electric is not zero emissions. It's you're splitting nukes, you know, you're splitting atoms, you're burning coal, you're burning electricity. There's some little bit of hydro, there's some little bit of wind, some little bit of solar, but it's mainly nuclear waste or, you know, CO2 generating coal. So don't call it zero emission.
Well, yeah, but that's really the sell in, you know. Oh, just plug it in. Oh, I haven't bought gas in so long in my bowl. It's all wonderful. Somebody's paying somewhere down the road, and we're paying. And, you know, Peter brings up a good point. You know, the Chinese, their power generation is coal dependent, and they're signing up for, you know, bad environmental breathing, brow, you know, whatever they're doing. It's not going to work. It just isn't going to work.
Well, to me, you know, the thing is, you know, we're going to have to wait a till the end of the decade, I think, before it catches, you know, the rest of the world catches on, or the general public catches on to the fact that unless you throw massive subsidies at these cars, they're not going to sell in big numbers.
No. And, you know, like I said, I had the Volt, and it's an incredible engineering achievement by the GM guys and women who worked 24/7 for, you know, 4 years on that thing, unlike Lieutenant Dan, who said, oh, well, we got to end the culture here that ends at 5 o'clock. He obviously hasn't been around the company very much, because I don't know anyone who works at General Motors who leaves at 5 o'clock. Or if they do, they're going to go do something in relating to work, yeah, or they're going to do more work at home.
Or if they did leave at 5 o'clock, it's because they started at 5 a.m.
Yeah, yeah, so... you know, the Volt is a technological wonder, and I appreciate what was accomplished, but we can't shove the EV mandate down people's throats. It's not going to work.
Right.
I mean, especially, you know, the ICE has many, many much more potential for growth in its efficiency. And, you know, another study just came out that's pretty much tipping that point that ICEs are going to gain efficiency, and we haven't even really seen how good they're going to get. And when you have ICEs getting, you know, 45, 50, 55 miles, 60 miles per gallon, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's very frustrating. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, The Center for Automotive Research came out this week and said if the United States pushes for a corporate average fuel economy of 62 miles per gallon, which is the upper end of the target that's right. being talked about, they're saying it's going to add anywhere from roughly $4,000 to $9,000 to the price of a car.
I absolutely believe it.
Well, I believe that they're right. And what the point they're making is if the average car buyer sees car prices jump up by that much, they're going to hold on to the car they got as long as they can,
yes.
which means there'll be no fuel economy improvement or very slow rate of improvement.
Yes. So, Peter, what's going on in Australia that's good?
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, we've been very fortunate because of our exports to China that our economy has not suffered to anything like the same extent that yours has or that it has in Europe. And car sales are still strong. We're a country of 22 million people. We still are selling a million vehicles a year, which is pretty good.
That is.
Toyota is number one in Australia. After many years of GM, i.e. Holden, being number one and alternating with Ford. But what we're facing with our industry here, unfortunately, is that while we have an indigenous car industry and we have uniquely Australian cars like the Australian Ford Falcon, which astonishingly enough is an absolutely logical evolution from the 1960 compact Falcon. In fact, today's 4-litre Falcon engine, which has got twin cams and four valves and fuel injection, and there's a 400 horsepower turbo version of it, has the same bore centers as the six-cylinder engine. I think it was 2.4 liters back in September 1960. So there's a long, long history of the Falcon in Australia, same thing with Holden and the Commodore. But we are facing, because of declining sales, because of the increasing globalization of product development, i.e. one Ford, because of the strength of the Australian dollar, and Australian dollar will buy $1.07 American now.
Amazing.
Which has decimated exports. So Holden exports have fallen from 60,000 a year in 2003, 2004, to 7,000 last year. So you can imagine the impact that has on a plant. So I don't think that we will see another all-new Australian car from either Ford or Holden.
That's a shame. And I want to get more into that, but we really got to take our first commercial break here. And right now we want to thank our sponsor, Chevrolet. Not only does the Chevrolet Cruze offer a ton of features, it features some of the best safety and maintenance in the business. The Cruze comes with rear park assist, which beeps if you're about to back into something. It has rollover mitigation, which means the car senses if it might roll over, and applies the brakes to the outside front tire to bring the car back under control. And it has OnStar vehicle diagnostics, which sends you emails about the latest status of your car. And you can learn a lot more about it at Chevrolet.com/cruise.
And we should remind everyone that Corvette Racing had a great triumph at Le Mans.
Great race.
Their seventh class win in the French Endurance Classic, and it was a great race anyway. For Audi, holding off the Peugeot team with one car after two spectacular massive crashes took the other two cars out.
No, that's right. In fact, what did Peugeot take? Second, third, fourth, and fifth right after that.
Yeah, three factory cars and a independent or something like that.
That's right.
But it was a great great win for Corvette Racing, and they're just up the road here.
I know, yeah. Home team, really.
Yeah, literally home team, like 20 minutes from here.
Well, we had Doug Feith, on the show, and got to get him back on and talk more about that program.
Yeah. And, you know, Mark Royce was over there for the first time. He'd never been, so he had a fantastic time.
Cool.
So,
that's good to hear.
Yeah.
So let's get back to Australia. You know, you're right, Peter. You had to have an indigenous car companies, or two car indigenous car companies that have developed cars there. Other manufacturers, right? Toyota manufacturers there. And I know Mitsubishi
used to.
Is it still there or no?
Yes, Mitsubishi bought the old Adelaide plant in South Australia, which where Chrysler Valiants were built for a few decades. but Mitsubishi stopped production in 08. So we're left with three manufacturers now. We've also had people building to 95% local content in Australia. Volkswagen through the late 50s and 60s. The British Motor Corporation, if you remember them, they left in 74. And Nissan left in 94, I think.
And as you mentioned, you know, Ford took the Falcon over there, and then its Australian operation started modifying it and changing it and really totally transformed the car altogether.
That's right. Jack Telnak, as a 29-year-old, was sent down to Australia to create a design studio. And Gene Bordenay at the time said to him, and I think this is a wonderful quote, "Go down there and do something, just don't make my telephone ring." So he went down, created a design studio, and the third generation Falcon, which came out in 1972, was an Australian design. And there were subsequent cars, and I think we're now into our eighth generation. So the last six have been created in Australia. Unfortunately, the Falcon is slipping down the sales charts. I think it's number eight year to date so far. And it would appear that in 2016, 2017, local production will go away, and we don't know this, but the question really is, will they assemble an American car, and I'm guessing the next generation of the Taurus, in Australia, or will it be fully imported? The problem, again, is the strength of the Australian dollar. It means that exports are ridiculously expensive, but imports are very cheap.
That's great point. What do you think is going to happen? Because as well as the Falcon, there's the Falcon Ute as well. Sort of like a little pickup truck for our viewers who haven't seen that sort of thing. And that can be a dynamite vehicle to drive.
Sure. And, well, Holden also have one, the Commodore Ute. Their passenger derivative, they're like the El Camino, really. Mm-hmm. And there's been efforts by General Motors to sell the Ute in the United States. There's been a few issues with the UAW, which have prevented that from happening. But I think because you can get the 6.2-litre V8, the Chevy small block in the car, it's a two-seater sports car. And the same with the Falcon. You can get a turbocharged 400-horsepower rear-drive Ute, which is an oversteer special.
Yeah. What's going to become of GM's and Ford's operations? Because, as you pointed out, Jack Telnak went down there, started a design studio for Ford. Holden's got a design studio, full engineering capabilities. I mean, they truly standalone companies. They can do everything.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Well, Holden especially, and they are the last to have done an all-new car, which was the VE car, which is underpinning the Camaro. But if you go back even to the previous generation, which drew its basic design from the large Opel, the Amiga, even in 1993, 94, there was an idea to create a Buick from that previous generation Commodore. It was the Buick 127, and it was shown as a concept car. Let me just check. The XP2000 at the 1995 Detroit show didn't go anywhere, but it got to the exploratory stage, and the work on that car helped give Holden the capability of building left-hand drive, and they have been successful in exporting cars to the Middle East. And also, you might remember the Pontiac GTO, which was the Australian Holden Monaro. Unfortunately, it arrived in the United States in 2004, I think, or late 2003, by which time the styling was a bit old hat and it never achieved what it should have achieved. But while that was happening, Holden, having looked at the Sigma platform, which is used to underpin the Cadillac CTS, there was a move to try and take some cost out of that so it could be used as the basis for the all-new Commodore. They couldn't make it work. It was an issue with packaging and various other things. So Holden began an all-new architecture, which was largely driven by two men, Peter Hannenberger, who had been refused the CEO's position because of the union union pressure in Germany, refused the CEO position at Opel. So he was given a lifeline to Holden and came down and essentially decided to create Peter Hannenberger Motors and take Holden outside the GM world. And to a very large extent, he was successful in doing that. The other person who was critical to it was designer Mike Simcoe, who spent 6-7 years in Detroit as the head of exterior design for GM. But before he went to Detroit, he created the new architecture in the sense that he wanted the proportions of the E39 5 Series, very short overhangs, stretched the wheelbase by 5 inches, and created the car which became the Pontiac G8.
Right. Terrific car, by the way, too.
A terrific car. And that car in six-cylinder form and V8 is the best-selling car in Australia still today. But at the time that this was going on, there was a very famous visit in February 2002 by Bob Lutz, Jim McQueen, Tom Stevens and Larry Burns, pretty heavy hitters, to Australia to drive the Australian product and to look at the preliminary work on the car that became the Commodore stroke G8. And they subsequently developed a plan to have a rear drive Chevrolet Impala, a couple of Buicks, Pontiac GTO, a long wheelbase Cadillac, and there was even an idea to put the new 3.6 litre V6 engine on one crank and create a V12 engine for something which was along the lines of the wonderful and very beautiful Cadillac V16. But unfortunately, costs overtook them, and that plan was killed off, although you do have two Camaros, the coupe and the convertible, and they were developed essentially in Australia. They were designed by GM designers sent down from the United States, but a lot of the engineering work was done at Holden. Huh. Now, with the new General Motors post-bankruptcy, the engineering homerooms that they have around the world, one Rüsselsheim in Germany, one in Korea, of course, at the old Daewoo factory, and Detroit, Holden was part of that. It was an engineering homeroom, but that is no longer the case, and Holden will take the Zeta and keep developing it, but they will never do a full reskin of that car, at least that's my understanding. So we're not really sure what the future of that car is and what the future of engineering is in Australia. So they have a very successful design studio. I think 70% of the work they do is either for Opel or Korea or even a bit for the United States. And that's under Simcoe, who's come back to Australia, and Tony Stolfo, who's another Australian, a very good designer. So we're in a very interesting flux state at the moment. A lot of anxiety.
I can imagine there is, because, you know, as you mentioned before, Ford wants to do one Ford, do the same thing the world over. I got to believe General Motors is going to go very much down the same sort of path. And I think it's highly questionable what's going to happen or whether those operations are going to survive as we know them.
Yeah, unfortunately. There was a plan 4 years ago, or it had been under progress for a couple of years by Ford for a new rear-wheel drive architecture to have a new Crown Victoria, Town Car, Australian Ford Fairlane, there's an old name for you, a new Falcon. And it was when Ford were going through that crisis. It was killed off, I think, just before Alan Mulally arrived. But, of course, this brings into the question of the future of Lincoln, and I'm sorry to get away from Australia, but they had a new LS, a second-generation LS, all set to go, and that was canned at about the same time. So there's been a lot of product come out of the system at both Ford and at GM.
Hey, we'll get back into more of this in just a moment, but it's time to thank another one of our sponsors here, and this time we really want to thank Hyundai. The sixth generation of the Hyundai Sonata is taking the industry by storm, and no wonder. It offers a fluidic design theme that gives it a strikingly modern, coupe-like exterior design. And yet the interior provides the roominess of a full-size car as measured by the EPA. The Sonata also provides an eco-friendly interior with soy-based foam for the seats. Put it all together with Hyundai's strong reliability and value proposition, and you've got yourself a really compelling package. Check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. So, Peter, what else is going on in the Australian market? We've been talking a lot about Holden and Ford. Who else is making waves there these days?
Hyundai and Kia doing very, very well.
That's Hyundai, the story the world over, I think.
Well, it is. And they're now the fifth manufacturer in Australia. They have 8.6% of the local market. And they are, they could overtake Mazda, who's number four, and even Ford, who have 9% and are number three. But they're doing extremely well.
Do the Europeans?
One of the interesting things is that they do have dynamic issues in Australia. Our roads are crap. And we get a version of the Sonata, which is called the I-45. We get hydraulic power steering. You people get electric power steering, which is interesting in itself. But in terms of steering, we get kickback. We get a very inconsistent loading of the steering. And they're just not pleasant cars to drive. And they've got a long... They're very successful in every other area. Quality, design, equipment, value for money, and so on. But dynamically, they leave a lot to be desired.
How about the Europeans?
You might laugh at this, but for 16 years until the early 80s, Volvo were the number one European in Australia. We went through a period when we had 45% import duty and import quotas, and the local manufacturers were guaranteed 80% of the market. And it was quite an artificial situation, of course. And Volvo led the way. Today, I think Volvo is number seven or number eight among the Europeans. But Volkswagen, as part of their plan to conquer the world, is on the rise very much. Skodas are sold in Australia. Audi is doing extremely well and threatening BMW and Mercedes-Benz. So there's there is much more activity from the Europeans now than there really has been for probably 40 years.
And you've got some Chinese cars now, too, or Chinese-made cars, don't you?
Yes, we have Great Wall and we have Chery, but they're not in all states. And Great Wall is selling commercial vehicles and SUVs. They've done very well based upon value for money. I've not driven any of them yet, but they're coming, and they're coming very quickly.
Interesting. How's the motor racing scene? You know, you've got a couple of Aussies racing in the U.S. in the IndyCar series that are doing pretty well.
Yes, we have. They're doing very well. Well, Australian motor racing really is dominated by the V8 supercars, which have a 14-round series, which includes one round in Abu Dhabi and one in New Zealand. Talk of another round in Singapore. They are essentially sprint races, but they're also long-distance races, including a 500-kilometer race, don't ask me to convert that to miles, at Phillip Island, which is where the MotoGP Australian Grand Prix is held, and also at our most famous circuit, which is Mount Panorama at Bathurst, which is 200 miles west of Sydney. And this is it really is a road which climbs up and over a mountain and down the other side, and there's a strait called Conrod Strait, where the cars can reach 300 kilometres an hour, and it's shown on Your Speed Channel in the United States, and it's in October, and it's a fantastic race. Unfortunately, there are only two manufacturers involved, Ford and Holden. The class is going more towards the NASCAR image, NASCAR idea of using a silhouette formula.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because, you know...
It is very unfortunate. I couldn't agree more.
The V8 Supercar Series, if NASCAR just stopped thinking, just stopped thinking anything to do with their cars, they should copy the V8 Supercar Series and you know, make that NASCAR here. But I hate to hear that they're going to any sort of commonality of body work. That's just the wrong way to go.
It's been a disaster here, Peter.
Yes. Well, it's not quite the commonality, but it's more they share gearboxes and diffs. But the plan for the future is that, and they're trying to invite manufacturers into it. But who's going to go into it if they sell front-wheel drive cars just to create a rear-wheel drive car just for a racing series, which is absolutely dominated by Ford and Holden. It's terrific racing. It's wonderful, wonderful racing. But it doesn't have a lot to do with the reality of the road cars that we drive. And that was the way this race, the Bathurst 1000, began. It was a race for production cars, and we had VW Beetles and Toyota Corollas and all sorts of normal cars in it. And it, over the years, it's gradually evolved into a unique formula.
Well, you know, maybe we ought to take another commercial break here and then get into some of the questions from the audience, get into rapid fire. So at this point, we really want to thank our sponsor, Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Okay, and now it's time to get to part of the show that we call Rapid Fire. Ben, let's bring it up. Okay, we got a question from Ray Schaffer to Peter Robinson. He says, Peter, I understand Pontiac is close to your heart. If you were in Bob Lutz's shoes when you were working, when they were working, to convert the Holden Monaro into a GTO, what would have you done differently to make it a success?
I wouldn't have called it a GTO.
Yeah,
might have called it a Tempest or a Le Mans, but I think the name was wrong. Unfortunately, it took too long to get to the American market. If Bob had arrived at GM 2 years earlier and the GTO had arrived, say, in 2001, it would have had much more chance of success.
What do you think about the original GTOs? Could they be considered collector's items? I mean, the original rebirth of the, you know, the Monaro GTO.
I don't think so here. I think for the enthusiasts who got them, I think they're great, and I'm sure they'll appreciate them for a long time, but they'll never be, you know, the originals.
Yeah. You know.
But they were fun to drive.
They were fun to drive. Absolutely true. Hey, I see we've got a bunch of phone calls coming in. Ben, let's get to the first one of them.
Hi, this is Dan in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. I had a question about Opel being up for sale again, and I was just wondering how many of the board members are still on from when they voted down Fritz Weaver or Fritz Henderson from getting rid of Opel when they should have the first time. I know Big Ed was part of that, but obviously he's no longer part. But how many of the original board members that made that decision the wrong way not too long ago are still on there, if you know? I appreciate it. Love the show. Thanks.
I don't have the exact number, so...
I want to say about half the board members are the same as before, but I don't have the exact number on that. And, you know, remember, this report of Opel possibly being up for sale came out of the German media. General Motors is denying that it's up for sale, although it has not put out an official release. Again, the denials are coming out of the German media, too. But, look, Opel's been losing money for a long time. GM wanted to restructure it. It's very hard to close plants and lay off people in Europe, but especially in Germany. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody came along with a big enough checkbook that they would sell it.
Yeah, I agree.
But who would want to buy it? Would it be one of the Chinese?
I would think so.
It's not going to be one of the Europeans.
No.
No, you're right. It will not be, but... Look, Opel has, again, it's a total standalone company. It has excellent design and engineering. It has a big manufacturing footprint. It has superb technology. Now, there would be a mess by whoever bought it because, in most cases, a lot of that technology belongs to General Motors. So that could be pretty dicey. Nonetheless, you know, if a Chinese company wanted to have instant access to absolutely first-rate technology or engineering and other capabilities, Opal's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's turnkey.
It's very interesting because Nick Riley, who runs the show, wants to take Opal globally. And there is a plan to introduce Opal, a name which is not known by many Australians, as a brand in Australia next year, alongside the Daewoos, which are sold in Australia badged as Holdens, just as they're badged as Chevrolet Cruze. So it's called a Holden Cruze in Australia. But this week in Automotive News, Akerson is quoted as saying that Opal will remain a regional brand. So I think that there is a there is no concord between the various General Motors executives at the moment about what they want Opal to be.
Interesting. Ben, let's bring in the next one.
Hey, John Rick from San Diego. Yeah, on the GM thing, I think they need to really get focused on being General Motors, meaning Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, and Cadillac. I mean, Buick, GMC last month, or last, I think, 19 months, is attracting a lot of non-GM buyers, over 50% in some of their models, yet there's nothing really new for them. The Verano's coming, but very hit and miss. Chevrolet, they've got they have great products, new products, the Sonic, they have Cruze, the new Malibu coming up, all that stuff's great, but they seem to be focused more in the middle of the price range, not in the bottom. So they're a little weak on the bottom level, strong in the middle, but they should be stronger in the bottom. Let Buick take the middle and Cadillac to the top. And leaving, they just seem to be stepping over each other. So any comments? Thanks.
Well, I still think GM is struggling with marketing of their various nameplates in the U.S. market. I mean, they have redundancies and overlaps, which we're all supposed to be taking care of when they jettison the extra divisions. I know for a fact they're still struggling. You can see it in some of these Buicks are right at Chevrolet price levels, mm-hmm. but they're premium, but the Chevrolets are better now and they're premium, so they're still struggling with it. Not as bad, not to the degree they were. I still don't think they should have killed Pontiac, but that's another show.
That is another show, that's right. We've got a great comment here from Mark O'Grady. He says, I'm fortunate to be driving a 2009 Pontiac G8 GT. Rather than thinking of it as a daily driver, I prefer to think of her as my Aussie mistress. As you've already discussed, the G8 was built in Australia and is essentially a Holden Commodore. I'm curious if Mr. Robinson believes there's another Australian-built model of any make that absolutely should be sold in the North American market.
I think if Ford, the problem with Ford is not invented here. There's been a lot of resistance in Dearborn to the Falcon. I think the Ford Falcon and its various versions could have been sold in the United States probably for the last 10 years, maybe, because they have terrific engines. They're very good to drive. They have Ford Dynamics has been excellent. And I think there would have been a market with the Ute and with the performance versions. The Falcon would have gone down very well.
I agree. In fact, a few years ago, I had a Falcon Ute to drive, and it was the performance version. It was a Tickford XR something or other. Which what model is it?
XR8.
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 So I drove it at the Woodward Avenue Dream Cruise here. I could have sold
fantastic.
Four or five of them if I had sales orders in the car. People came out of the woodwork. They loved the look of that thing.
Yeah.
And
over the years, the Falcon has been recognized within the Ford world with the XD, which was 1979, and then the EA Falcon, which was 1988, I think. Just beautiful, beautiful looking cars. And they did some clinics on those cars in Europe, took the badges off them. And everyone thought they were either BMWs or Mercedes-Benzes. The engineering and the driving wasn't there. The XD, for instance, was launched with leaf-sprung rear axle, three-speed automatic, should have been four-speed. So there have been engineering issues along the way, but they've sold all of those now. And they're terrific cars.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Kurt Crawford from Tularosa, New Mexico. I'd like to know if advanced manufacturing was a good idea or a bad idea. Love your show.
Advanced manufacturing.
Advanced manufacturing, yeah. I'm not sure what
all manufacturing is advanced these days, because if it isn't, you're out of business.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he means, unless he means that there's been some changes at General Motors where they've pulled people from advanced manufacturing into product programs, both in vehicles and in powertrain. So I don't know if he means, you know, was advanced manufacturing a good idea now? GM doesn't seem to have it. My theory is that GM desperately wants to pull programs forward. The new Malibu being a great example.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Dan wants to bring it 8 months forward. Well, that's not easy to do, especially not letting quality slip.
Yeah.
So it almost looks to me like they've pulled people out of advanced engineering and advanced advanced engineering, not manufacturing, to do it. But I guess we need more clarification on that question. Okay, Alan, Lake Orion, Michigan, says, hi, guys, another great show. My question for Peter is about the popularity of a vehicle like the Ute in Australia. Why is it that these vehicles work for the Australian market, and why companies, American companies like GM and Ford, will not build them here? They'd make a great small truck.
Well, they do. We don't get vehicles like the F-150. The Toyota Hiace, which is the Toyota range, is the best-selling pickup, to use the American term, in Australia. But a lot of young tradies, the plumbers and the electricians and the builders and so on, love having the Utes because they can buy the V8 version, and they've got a car because it's lighter than the sedans, which is quicker in acceleration. And although the sales, they were doing, I think best years were about 14,000 of each. That's backed off, and it's about half that now, perhaps even less. That's per year. But there is no reason why those vehicles wouldn't have sold in the United States. How popular were things like the Ranch? Was it Ranchero and El Camino?
Did they
do really well? Because that's what we're talking about.
They were popular in the 60s, early 60s.
Right.
More so in the early 60s. But remember, GM showed the Pontiac version of the Ute at the New York show.
Right.
And I remember standing next to, is it Bill Lochner?
John Lochner.
Yeah, John. I should know better. But I was standing next to John, and he was, you know, he had his GM pin on, and he was saying, this is going to be great for Pontiac. I said, John, well, it'll never see the light of day here. And he was taken aback. But I think they're cool, but they're strictly very low, limited production. You know, like you said, John, you drive it up and down Dream Coast and Dream Cruise, and everyone loves them. But the reality is, you know, to bring them over here, to commit to bring them over here, to sell them, and it's a tough way to go. And these manufacturers can't afford to do that unless they're, you know, real super, super, almost supercars, and they can bring them in at low production and charge a lot and make a lot of money, but that's
right.
Not the idea with that.
Well, there's two things, too. Remember, the Utes in Australia are also work vehicles. It's not just, you know, the XR8s and the like. So there's like a one-ton version of both the Holden and the Falcon Ute. And so that's how I think they make it work in Australia. Yeah, you can have these really cool high-performance versions, but you can have everyday work truck kind of ones, too. And the problem with bringing them into the United States is we have a 25% import tariff on pickup trucks. And that's why you don't see pickups being imported to the United States. Now, there are ways of getting around that. And Toyota came up with a very clever idea years ago, when it would bring in its compact pickup, just the cab and chassis with the powertrain. They manufactured the bed in California. They'd bolt that on at the port, and voila, somehow or other, it was considered an American-made vehicle, and it got around the import tariffs that way. And if you remember, Subaru had a little vehicle called the Brat.
The Brat, yeah.
Which was like a little pickup truck that actually had two seats in the bed of the truck with kind of handlebar grips that if you sat in the back that you could hold on to so you wouldn't be thrown out. The only reason they put those seats in the back is because that, quote unquote, did not make it as a pickup.
Right.
And that's how they avoided the 25% tax.
Right, right.
So yeah, bringing utes in would be a difficult proposition unless you use some of these tricks.
Yeah.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Hey, I have a question here for you. My name is Dan Smith. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. And I have a question for your Australian guest today. And I'm wondering how he thinks Holden feels about all the tortured fits and starts that Holden has gone through in order to gain a regular, some kind of regular access to the U.S. marketplace. Their product portfolio seems to dovetail perfectly with the wants and desires of the American car enthusiasts, and for some reason, there just seems to be an endless supply or an oversupply even of, niggling little, highly questionable reasons as to why they don't have, continuous, ongoing, ready access to this marketplace. Because I think, the American car enthusiasts would love to get their hands on an awful lot of stuff coming from Holden. And maybe the solution's right around the corner.
It's not an easy question to answer. Mark Royce is very familiar with it because, of course, he spent time in Australia. If Pontiac had not gone away, then I think the G8 would still be there and the updates of the G8 would have come along, and that would have been very beneficial for Holden and very beneficial for Pontiac. At the same time, there was a plan to do a small rear-wheel drive Pontiac out of the Alpha program, which is for Cadillac, and that could have become an Australian Holden Turana, which is another model that Holden had through the 60s, 70s, and into the early 80s. So there could have been a lot of global sharing, if you like, on going forward. Use that terrible expression, but it's just at the moment the idea is to try and sell the long wheelbase version of the Commodore, which is called the Caprice, as a Chevrolet police car in the United States, with the going away of the Crown Victoria. There's an obvious vacancy there for a rear-wheel drive police car, but unfortunately the Australian dollar, as I said, it's too strong. And that's going to make those cars very expensive. So I think if there'd been a will, and Bob Lutz was pushing and pushing and pushing, but with the bankruptcy of GM, so much went away. Holden was living day to day. I don't think there was ever a question, as there was with Opel, of selling Holden. I don't know who would have bought it, but it's been very, very difficult through the whole bankruptcy period. Holden got to the stage where they even discussed at board level selling their 800-hectare proving ground. So it was very, very difficult, as it was in Detroit.
You make a good point because, a decade ago, the Australian dollar was worth 50 cents American. Now it's worth more than the American dollar. So really, costs in terms of importing from Australia have doubled in a decade.
Yeah, that's right. I think when they were doing the VE Commodore, the Zeta program, they were looking at the Australian dollar being worth 65 cents.
Wow.
Now, of course, today the Commodore is less than 50% Australian, and the V8 engines and gearboxes are imported from North America. We do make the 3.6-litre engines, V6 engine in Australia, but the local content has diminished. Holden was extraordinarily vertically integrated through the 60s and 70s, even to the extent where they had their own tool room, which closed probably 30 years ago. But it was essentially an Australian car, and probably 2 or 3% of the componentry that went into it were imported. Today, it's over 50% is imported.
Okay, Goggles Pisano wants to know, why is it that the Aussies have managed to hang on to their full-size rear-drive Fords and Holdens while the North Americans have abandoned them?
The Australians could never afford to change the plants to convert to front-wheel drive. There was a lot of pressure from both GM and from Ford in the United States that they should do so, but they resisted that pressure. And there were three times when Dearborn insisted that the Falcon become either a European Granada or an American model. They resisted that. Effectively, it's like your grandfather's axe. It's still the same axe, but they changed everything. And somehow that was the way they kept going. They were never all new cars, but they would change the rear suspension and update that. They would change the engines. They'd introduce new gearboxes. They'd do a reskin. They just kept developing the car like that because they could never afford to go to front-wheel drive.
Well, I think the American manufacturers sort of walking away from rear-wheel drive is a mistake.
Big mistake.
And, I get the economies of scale. Okay, we do front-wheel drive and we do front-wheel drive platforms with all-wheel drive capability. But, you know,
it's not the same.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. You get different proportions when you design a car that's rear drive versus front drive. And the other thing, you know, we saw this happen in the 1980s when General Motors declared it was going to make everything front drive. Chrysler made everything the K car. Ford was crying because it couldn't afford to make that kind of conversion. And by the middle 80s, Ford could not keep up with demand for its rear drive cars. And when you look at what they're doing in powertrain these days, you can absolutely make rear drive get fantastic fuel economy.
Yeah.
And whoever gets there, whoever decides to go with a rear drive car, I'm not talking about the Europeans, you know, with their luxury cars where they charge a lot of money. Somebody who decides to do a family sedan in the U.S. that's rear drive and affordable for most families, I think it'll do terrific.
I do, too.
Well, that was the great strength of Holden through the late 90s. There was a recognition in GM that there was rear-wheel drive expertise in Australia, and they tried to take advantage of it, but they, for a thousand reasons, they've not been able to take full advantage of it, and it is a great shame. Next year, the Commodore, which could be the G8, could have been a Chevrolet. There was a plan to badge engineer it when Pontiac went away to do it as a Chevrolet, but they resisted that. For their own, I'm sure, good reasons, but they're going to introduce aluminium panels. They're going to introduce electric power steering, all to lower the fuel consumption, so that they're much more fuel efficient. Will be much more fuel efficient than they were even 3 or 4 years ago. So it's an ongoing evolutionary thing, in order to try and sustain rear wheel drive. And if Ford drops the Falcon, then that leaves Holden as the only rear-wheel drive manufacturer in Australia. And there will be a lot of people who grew up with rear-wheel drive, like us, who just love it and realize that it does give you the proportions you need for good-looking cars and a driving style which is, I still find, far preferable to front-wheel drive.
It's just a better feel. I don't care how they do it, you know. Say, well, this all-wheel drive is just... No, it isn't. The rear-wheel drive is better to drive, more fun to drive. You feel like you're driving something. That can't change. I mean, they're never going to...
It's loading up the outside back wheel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You load up the outside back wheel, and you just think, I'm a hero. And you can't do that in front-wheel drive.
Yeah, no, you can't. And all-wheel drive sort of, you just takes the fun out of it completely, so...
Yeah. Ben, we've got another phone call. Let's bring it in.
Hey, people. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio.
Hey, Youngblood. Hey.
My question and comments are to Mr. Peter Robinson from Australia or in Australia. Mr. Robinson, you are the luckiest guy to have those Australian V8 supercars. I've watched them here on American TV. Those are fantastic. What a fantastic series. I saw their finale. I think it was in Surfer's Paradise last year. And if I can, in the next couple of years, I want to try to get a vacation there. It just looked fantastic. Can you relate to us how many of those kind of cars in some form, waveform shape, are actually available on a street, like the Holdens and the Falcons and all those high-performance vehicles that we just lick our chops hoping that we can get some of them over here? And is there any rumors that some of them might be coming here? Thank you very much, and good day to you. Bye.
Well, they are trying to take it globally, but whether I think conquering the United States would be a little difficult. But it is a terrific series. I agree with you. And the racing is very close. You can sometimes get a grid of 30 cars and there might be a second between the pole sitter and the number 30 car. The racing is in staggeringly intense and hard fought, and there are a lot of young drivers who are coming through. It's a terrific series. I'm sorry, I missed the point of the question.
I don't think there was much of a point. I think he was just
making some comments. I think you answered it just fine.
Yeah, you answered it just fine.
It would be kind of cool to see, at least to do a demonstration race with some of the top teams here.
Well, it's just, it's such a void here. I mean, we need, a couple weeks ago I wrote a column in the Fumes about we need one great road racing series in this country. The ALMS has to cease and desist. Grand Am has to cease and desist. There has to be one new great series, road racing series.
What's wrong with reviving Trans Am racing?
Well, basically, the V8 Supercar Series is the logical extension of the Trans Am Series from the early 70s, late 60s. And this country needs that kind of series. And ALMS, the GT2 series right now is the best road racing in the world. And all they have to do is expand that and maybe have another class below it, but have one great series, because the prototypes are great, but we can't sustain prototype racing in the U.S. without manufacturer involvement.
Right.
And we only have that twice now. We have it at Sebring and Petit Le Mans.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you'll get to see the Audis and the Peugeots square off. Otherwise, we need great GT road racing, and we need one series. We don't need World Challenge, Grand Am, ALMS, SCCA. We need one great series.
One series, but I would say different categories.
Yeah.
I would love to see, what was it called, GTU in the Trans Am.
Oh, yeah, no.
Two-liter engine.
That's what I'm saying. You have two levels. Well, maybe even a third. I mean, some people have talked to me, maybe we have a third, and I said, I don't know. You'd be hosing those front wheels drive cars out of the grills of those big cars at the end of the race. So, but we need that. And the V8 Supercar Series, I'm glad it exists because, you can see that's a logical extension of the original Trans Am.
One of the things about it, too, is that there's such variety in the racing circuits that it's not just an oval, and some of them are genuine road circuits, some of them are racetracks. But the variety means that it's very difficult to engineer a car which is absolutely perfect for each of those tracks. And that adds to the variety, adds to the interest of the racing.
Yes.
That's a great point. When you mix it up in the season so that one team just doesn't dominate all.
Well, even NASCAR. I mean, the two NASCAR road races are the best races of the year. And if NASCAR added, and this is something I've been advocating for years, add more road races within the NASCAR schedule. Don't add to the schedule, of course.
Right.
But add more road races in the schedule, and I think it would help NASCAR a great deal.
I agree totally, and those are the two road course races they have are my two favorite to watch.
And you could just imagine if they ran at Road America, Road Atlanta, Barber Motorsports Park, Laguna Seca,
It'd be awesome. Ben, I think we've got another phone call.
Hey, this is Jonathan out in Old Japan, New Jersey. Great show. Wonderful to have Peter from Australia on the show giving us insights. My question is, and I'm not a big Ford fan, but is the new Ford Mustang, which is a rear-wheel drive platform, going to be shared with a product in Australia, possibly, to get the economies of scale for that rear-wheel drive platform? And would it be possible for General Motors to import, let's say, a future Holden G8-type vehicle from Australia and just export from the United States or Canada, let's say, the Camaro? And if the quantities were, the volumes were identical, wouldn't that, in fact, possibly negate some of the valuation of the Australian dollar being greater than the American dollar? Thank you very much. It's a wonderful show, and you guys are always fantastic. Thank you.
Well, I think there were several questions in there, actually. Thanks for that call, Jonathan. Peter, what do you think? Any chance that maybe Australia would get a rear drive platform for Ford or get to develop the next Mustang platform or something like that?
Well, Ford Australia was going to be involved in the development of this global rear-wheel drive platform. When I say global, it really means the United States and Australia, a little bit of exports to New Zealand, South Africa, not really Europe or anywhere else. There was a plan that Australia would be involved in that architecture, which was killed 4 years ago. And I don't know whether Mustang was included in that. Logically, it should be, of course, because the Mustang came out of the original Falcon. So why not do it again? We've been writing about this for 15 years in Wheels magazine in Australia and saying, why don't they do it? There was an idea to use a common independent rear suspension in the 04 Mustang, but there were issues with that. And although the program got quite a long way down the track, it was eventually killed on the grounds of cost. But by the time they had re-engineered the car back to a live rear axle, they realized that if they kept going with the independent, the pricing of building the Mustang would have been the same as it was with the live rear axle. So that was an unfortunate decision. Whether the 2014 Mustang gets a live rear axle, I don't know. It's a very logical thing to do, but it hasn't happened.
Well, look, it's probably about time we should wrap this show up. I got a couple of announcements to make, though. In 2 weeks, we're doing the AutoLine After Hours draft, where Peter DeLorenzo and I, along with Jim Hall and Ed Lapham from Automotive News, are going to do a draft of our top executives. We're each going to have our own car company. And in fact, we've got a little promo for this right now. Ben, let's run that.
Hey, America, I'm hitting the road for some research. I'm starting in California. Stopping in Asia.
Hey-ya!
And wrapping up in Europe. Before heading back to Detroit for the first ever AutoLine After Hours Fantasy Automotive Draft. For all the details, check our website, AutoLineDetroit.tv, and join us there Thursday, June 30th at 7 p.m. Eastern as we draft our automotive super teams. You can keep a secret, my first round draft choices.
I want to know who's going to be the design boss.
Well, we're each going to be drafting for our own companies, and if somebody gets to draft their pick, the other companies can't touch it. So this is going to be fun. And then we're going to have Scott Burgess from the Detroit News and Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press doing the play-by-play analysis as we go through our draft.
Yeah.
So that's 2 weeks from now. That's going to be a lot of fun. But Peter Robinson, thanks so much for joining us from Sydney, Australia. It's been terrific having you on the show tonight.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good to see you, Peter.
And Peter DeLorenzo, great having you here as well.
Great to be here, John, by the last, very last second.
Yeah. Thanks, folks, for having joined us tonight.
Visit our website, AutoLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutoLineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.